Thank you for tuning in for another installment of the Powerful Thirst Podcast. The podcast that you're about to listen to is with Donald Patz of Patz and Hall Winery. We were lucky enough to catch up with Donald at the end of a great luncheon sponsored by the winery at Bouchon at the top of the Venetian in Las Vegas on August the 25th, 2015. And Donald was kind enough to give us a couple of minutes at the end of that luncheon to talk shop. The sounds that you will hear in the background are the usual restaurant sounds. We hope that it doesn't disturb your enjoyment of the podcast. And more often than not, this is exactly the way things happen in the real business world with lots of activity around, and you try and catch the great people when you can, whenever you can. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to another episode of Powerful Thirst. I'm your host, the man of Powerful Thirst, John Patton, and I'm here today joined with Donald Patz, one half of Patz and Hall Winery. And we just got through with a fantastic second annual luncheon here in Las Vegas where we got to taste a lot of great wines. And we had the opportunity to actually sit down with Don for a couple of minutes and talk about, how did you get to where you are? Because I know your background, you didn't originally start out in wine, did you?
Well, no, not originally, but the first real job I had after college was with a wine wholesaling company. So it's not like I made billions of dollars in high tech or something like that and then rolled it into the wine business. We started really on a shoestring. Patz and Hall has been a labor of love from the very beginning and something that we're very passionate about.
So what about those actual early days? Like, how did that nexus of energy really come together?
Well, James Hall and I met when we both worked at Flora Springs Winery. And he'd been the assistant winemaker there for a little while. I just got hired to be in charge of sales. And unbeknownst to me, there had been a guy in front of me that had been fired after about 3 months.
So, it does happen.
It does happen.
That's why there's a 90-day clause.
Yeah, that's right. And so the winemaker at the time, Ken Dice, who's now one of my best friends, looked at me as a short-timer. So I walked out into the winery looking for somebody to ask questions about the wines I was supposed to sell for Flora Springs. And I see this guy who's got like a three-day growth of beard, kind of disheveled looking, filling barrels, probably was hungover. And that was my future business partner, James Hall. We struck up a conversation that day and then subsequent days and stayed in touch when he became the winemaker at Honig Cellars and realized that we were both kind of thinking about the same thing, which was each of us was thinking it'd be cool to have our own little wine project that would, you know, maybe be creative but at the same time offer potential for perhaps a better vacation every year. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that we had sort of an interesting combination since we had somebody in James who knew how to make wine and particularly how to make the kind of wine that I was interested in, and we had somebody on the other side who knew kind of how to present it to the market and to sell it, which was me. And that was unusual at the time. There weren't a lot of people coming together with such divergent experience, and so I suggested to him that that maybe we ought to work together. And so actually what happened was James and his longtime lover, Ann Moses, and my wife at the time, Heather Patz, and the four of us formed Patz and Hall and are still all currently active in Patz and Hall.
Fantastic. Well, I can tell you from my experience from being on the other side of the table in the buying chair that I see lots of people with lots of passion show up who actually made the wines, and then I try and go, give me your 30-second pitch. Like, your wine is directly competing with wine X. What can I give to my people in a pre-shift that's really going to make a difference in that decision? And you see the light go on. They never actually thought about what the actual interactions were actually going to happen when it comes to actually making those wine decisions happen at the table. And it's like, you know, you can't go out and say, I'm better. So, you know, I always appreciate when business people come to the table. Okay, this is our plan, and where we're moving forward our business. So you started out with a low entry level capital model, so you couldn't purchase your own vineyards. So was it hard getting taken seriously back in those days?
Well, Yeah.
Because it was a relatively new
one. It was. We're brand new. Nobody's ever heard of us. Who would want to...
Beyond that, were there that really made that many people at that point in the Valley that were really creating wine models without a winery, without vineyards?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But it never really occurred to us at the time that we were like creating this brand new model out of nowhere. I mean, we knew that there was additional capacity at many wineries and that there were people that were utilizing it in various ways. Sometimes other wineries would ask a second winery to help them by crushing grapes or things like that. And there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So we knew there was this opportunity out there. We also knew that especially in Napa, there was, at the time, about 50% of the grapes were owned by independent growers. So we knew that the grapes were available for sale. A lot of them were under contract, but it wasn't like every grape was already headed towards an estate winery. So those two pieces of information, plus what we knew about winemaking and what we knew about selling, helped us to get Patson Hall started. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when you come out with a brand that doesn't even have a wine made yet, and you're talking with growers about potentially coming up with grapes for you, it's a leap of faith for them to believe that you're going to, one, actually take the grapes, and two, actually pay for the grapes when you're just getting started. And it was quite a number of years before we really came to a point where the growers understood that we were dependable and we were making wines that were getting attention. And then things started to change quite a bit.
So was there anybody in those early days that really helped you out? Like, was there really a friction point, we need to get more growth to be taken seriously? Like, was there somebody who really in those early days really helped you out to really put your model over the top?
Well, the first grapes we got were from John Caldwell, who is a terrific guy. And the Chardonnay grapes that he sold us really helped us to get started.
And where's he from?
He has a vineyard actually on the east side of Napa, and has his own little label as well, but has sold grapes. He was selling most of his grapes to Jason Pallmeyer. And he had a Chardonnay block that Jason was not using, so it gave us an opportunity to buy some fruit. But probably once we got down the road just a little bit, we were making a little bit of wine. The biggest help early on was being able to buy grapes from Larry Hyde. Grapes became available because one of his customers went bankrupt, and we stepped in and started buying grapes. And James Hall has made a very close friend out of Larry Hyde, not just because of business, but because they found a lot in common. But it's really helped us a lot.
From a sommelier standpoint, he has actually been very welcoming every time that I want to take some of my sommelier crews up to go visit, to go visit the property. He's always been very welcoming, and he was really doing Pinot out on the outer fringes before anybody really was out in that sort of no man's land down in.
Talking about Larry Hyde
down in Carneros.
Carneros, way back was sort of going to be the promised land for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Acacia, for example, back in the late 70s and early 80s, made some terrific wines. And there were some other people that were sort of, our friends over at Sainsbury. There were other people that had been doing it. But when Larry Hyde started planting and really taking both Chardonnay and Pinot Noir very seriously there, he has really transformed the territory down. And I think that Carneros has benefited greatly from having Hyde Vineyard there.
Mm-hmm. So with your model, now we fast forward up to where we're at today, and now we're actually able to look at a retrospective today of the 2006 Pinot out of the Magnum. And this is the Hyde Vineyard as well?
It is.
That is a really stunning glass of
wine. Yeah, it's really delicious.
And it's
not
because of the power that it has. There's just sort of a undefinable sumptuousness to it. It's just very welcoming. It's just a great drinking glass.
And you just did a great description of Pinot Noir. I think in general, that is exactly what it should be. It should be aromatically interesting. It should be, silky on the palate. There should be something really seductive about it. It's not, it is not a macho wine, but men can drink it.
And it was fantastic to have it up in the wonderful environment that we had it in this afternoon. And in the environment that we're in now in business, I mean, we've actually seen some very high-profile acquisitions by one of the large five for like the Siduris, where, you know, in most winery applications, if you want to go out and sell your property, you have basically a 6x revenue model is your fair value out of the marketplace. They got paid over 20, close to 30 times what their fair value was. So if you're going out in the market and paying 3x, obviously there's got to be some side of growth that you think you can grow it 3 to 4 times over where it is. You know, I've never been involved in that sort of that side of the wine business that you were, like with Flora Springs and actually trying to grow businesses like that. Are those dollars really worth it from an actual growth model? Or are you just trying to control that marketplace with the brands that they already have so they can get basically a wedge into restaurants that they didn't already have access to?
Well, I know Diana and mm-hmm. Adam Lee, and they are terrific people. I
absolutely
am thrilled to know them. And I am not privy to mm-hmm. any inside information about their deal or what the plans are for the brand. But, you know, as an outsider kind of looking at it, you sort of speculate about this. Of course, everybody does in the industry.
We all look at it and go,
what do you think they're going to do with that?
Exactly.
And why would they pay that much? Or, you know, why? I'm glad. First of all, I'm glad. I'm thrilled. Yeah. I wish they got 10 times more for theirs.
This is our reality TV in the wine.
We would
business.
Love to see them. I wish they got $250 million for theirs. Whatever it is, it's great for them, and they're nice people. They totally deserve whatever they got.
And it's not just in the wine business either. It's like Darden Group just paid on paper they paid $515 million for 27 Yard House restaurants. In no way could I possibly, from a valuation standpoint, make that actually make sense. But, you know, the guys at Darden, the guys at Landry's Group, you know, they don't make dumb decisions, so they've made it. So I'm trying to sort of like...
You had a plan.
I'm trying to look into the crystal ball.
I mean, let's just sort of say, if it was me, what would I be doing? What would I be thinking about it? I guess I would be thinking that there's some real potential to grow this brand, the Siduri brand, that there'd be an opportunity to expand both the Pinot program that they've been doing, but perhaps even maybe add some SKUs like Chardonnay, which they've not typically done. I don't know what their real plans are, but my guess is that their plan is to expand and expand not just in the current things that they're doing, but also add maybe some single vineyard stuff as well as other varieties, is my guess, and make a lot more cases, which means that, you know, there'll be a lot of Siduri coming to a store and restaurant near you.
Right, and there is certainly a model of scale you have when you go into business with a much larger company, that they have added capacity that's not going to cost you anything more to that particular brand. But that also leads to the most rational question. The wine industry itself, basically, if you look at the Nielsen numbers from last year, grew about 4% year over year. If you're paying 4x growth on a 4% basically growth model, that means that you have to necessarily either be taking advantage of certain niches in the market that are growing at faster than 4% growth, or you're looking at that actual winery is producing such a above value product that they can actually push further into the market.
I think your goal at that point is to, you know, to find somebody else out in the market who can push down into the mud puddle and take their lunch money.
Mm-hmm.
Your plan is to take somebody else's business, because there isn't an underlying factor of growth that justifies an expectation of massive increases in sales.
Now, would you say that's true even of Pinot? Like, I don't know off the top of my head what the actual growth in the actual Pinot market is.
Well, like the Pinot Noir is challenged on a couple of different levels. One is it's just really, really difficult to grow large amounts of it per mm-hmm. acre and get something that people are going to want to drink.
Yes.
So
from an agricultural standpoint, it's a
challenge. It's really expensive to grow, and, you know, the prices, I mean, really, if we get scraped down to it, the top-end Pinot prices should be at least as expensive as the most expensive Cabernet prices from Napa, because you can get at least twice as much Cabernet per acre at quality than you can Pinot Noir. So,
and that's just the nature of the grape.
That's just the nature of the grape. And also, it's not as easily planted as widely as Cabernet could be in California. It doesn't have to just be in Napa. There's plenty of other places in California that I think it would do pretty well. Pinot is really limited to just the coolest spots. It's going to be tough to find a lot more of the Pinot Noir grape. Not a lot of new plantings have been made. So,
and you would know having
we're looking at it. Yep, we're looking at it. We buy all of our grapes. We have long-term contracts with our growers. We have a fantastic relationship with them.
Yeah. But you also have a built-in advantage, being that you started that model so early. You can literally go out and actually pick the vines that you want to work with.
Well, of course, that's what you want to do, and it is what we've been able to do, is to go into these larger vineyards like Dutton Ranch, for example, and mark rows for Patson Hall and buy the grapes from those same vines year after year from what at least we think, is the best part of those vineyards. Right. The hilarious part is you get, you know, three winemakers running around there not talking to each other. They'll each pick three separate parts of the vineyards and claim that that's the very best part of the vineyard. So we're thrilled with the parts that we're getting from each one of our vineyards. But I suspect if another winemaker was out there walking around, they might not choose ours.
Mm-hmm. But what I have seen over the Patson Hall, and I've had them in, I'm lucky enough to say that I've actually been working with the Patson Hall wines for over a decade now, and it's amazingly consistent. Like the whole theme, whether you go through the individual vineyards, you see the craft, but you don't see the techniques. You see very holistic styles of winemaking that don't involve lots of tricks and smoke and mirrors. And if that's the way you're picking out your vineyards in the winery, then my hat's off to you.
Well, thank you.
Because the proof is in the bottle.
I think we have an amazing collection of families working together. Most of the vineyards we work with, in fact, I think all of them are family owned. So we're really fortunate to be able to bring together some really talented people, both in the vineyards and at the winery level, to be able to create these wines. And it's been extremely gratifying. We're in the process of making our 28th harvest at Patson Hall, which is kind of amazing to me. Sounds like a long time, and now it makes me feel old just to say that out loud. But it's wonderful.
Be a veteran. It means you did a lot of good work.
Yeah,
for
we worked hard for a long time. It's been a great run for us, and we want to continue that run. And I think if you come to the conclusion that you created your best wines and you'll never be able to surpass those again, it's probably time to move on. So each year we go out with the premise that we can do better, and we want to try to do better, and we ask more from our growers each year to try to get us to that goal. And it's been great because we've gotten a fantastic response from them.
Well, the 2014 Chardonnays you showed today
were good, weren't they?
Were absolutely delicious. And, you know, I always find it funny when people say that they don't drink this and they don't drink that. Me, I'm a man of a powerful thirst. I'm willing to take anything out for a test drive, and as long as it meets my savory needs, it's like.
So how did we do? How did we do today?
It was an absolutely fantastic afternoon.
Good.
But when I add up everything, the 05 Chardonnay was a revelation, because you don't really get aged Chardonnays in the U.S. or the opportunity to drink aged Chardonnays in the U.S. a lot.
That's it. Almost 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. Wine that we drank out of Magnums. And to be honest, there were two versions of it. There was the first Magnum, which I think was more kind of what most people would expect a 10-year-old Chardonnay to taste like. It was just slightly oxidized, but also beautifully complex. But the second one was just jumping out of the bottle. I could not believe how good that wine was. So it was wonderful to be able to show, especially that second Magnum.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard thing to actually translate to other people, that, you know, it's once you get to that age, they're all sort of, you know, it's kind of like when everybody's a baby, they all sort of look the same, and then as they grow up, they turn into different people.
Yeah, some people age more gracefully than
exactly,
others.
Right? Exactly.
That's what you're trying to say.
And
some of those 55 and 60 year old women are just gorgeous, and others maybe not so much. But
it's a beautiful thing to actually see, and I actually get a lot of enjoyment from, oh, God, this one's so much worse than the other one. No, it's just different.
Yeah.
It's just different.
No, I really didn't feel bad about that first one. I thought that it was really appropriate for the age, and I was thrilled that there was a second one that seemed so much younger and fresher and really revealed, you know, that unique character that can come through.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun to do that. And you know, at lunch when we were talking, you probably heard me say this, that every winemaker in the entire world will tell anybody that will listen, oh, my wines age so gracefully. You know, just wait 10 or 15 years, they're going to even be better. But they never show up with those. They never bring them to you and say, see, I told you it was. So I think it's really important for Patson Hall, since we've been around for 28 vintages, that we actually put up and show that the wines age gracefully if we're going to keep saying it. And we're thrilled to be able to share these with people that really enjoy it.
Well, I tell you, from a buying standpoint, normally what you hear about when I start asking about vintages is, man, you can't wait to taste the ones that are already in the fermenting tanks.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, of course, we're always looking
the most fresh.
Yeah, always looking forward to the thing that we're doing right now. It's really, yeah, of course, that's, I think, a really human kind of response is the thing that you're slaving over today is the most important thing to you, but it's wonderful to be able to look back as well and to know that, you know, we in our minds think we're doing even better, but look, hey, it wasn't so bad, was it? This really turned out great. It's really fun to be able to drink those wines and to share them. I'm not really all about tasting. When you're opening a bottle that's 10 or more years old, you should be drinking it, not tasting and dumping.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of one of the guys that I was lucky enough to start out the business with, Mr. Gary Butch. And we did a great Thanksgiving. We shut down the restaurant. We invited all of our best guests into the restaurant. And all of us regular line employees were required to bring sort of a potluck Thanksgiving. And what they provided was the actual restaurant, and they provided all the wine. And he opened up a Rieschborg. And I forget what vintage it was.
Doesn't matter. It was awesome, I'm sure. Yeah.
It was absolutely ethereal, and he was waiting for a very particular guest to come in because he knew that this particular guest loved bourbon, and it was just getting later and later on the day. Finally, Gary opens a bottle of wine, and he pours it out, and me and another one of the servers are there just chomping at the bit. And we put it into the glass, and you put your nose into it, and it is just one of the most mythical things ever. And we're so excited, and Gary goes, yeah, you need to have that drunk in the next 30 minutes. And sure enough, just after 30 minutes, all of a sudden it became more Madeira, sort of sherry kinds of tones.
Oxidized.
And it came, and it went. But when you got it during that just absolutely glorious...
To a magic hour.
Oh, it was just a beautiful, beautiful thing to behold. And, you know, now at 28 vintages, you've got the wherewithal to look back and take a look at everything that you've done. And now you can actually bring these wines out. And now you can have those kind of experiences that, yeah, right now, this is drinking as good as it can possibly be.
I think so. That's the goal, anyway. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Don, for all your time. My name is John Pedden. I'm a man of a powerful thirst, and thank you back for coming and seeing us this afternoon. And check back frequently for updates on the Powerful Thirst website, and we'll have new podcasts coming up soon.